You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science, this week we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
It's a lovely day here. We've been discussing Christmas music, getting into the festive season, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's sneaking up on us a bit.
It is, rather. I can't believe it's almost the end of 2024.
Yeah, we're getting really close to it. And we've got lots of science here to celebrate. And absolutely crazy stories here we've got this week. What's going on with these latrines and what are they teaching us? What are we learning?
Okay, so I saw the title 500-year-old latrine and I couldn't go past looking at the story. And it's basically teaching us about some intestinal parasites and trade routes and or trading and stuff. So basically in Bruges in Belgium in 1996, there was a latrine uncovered in an excavation. But nothing's really been done with the site until recently. There's been a multinational effort to start looking at its artifacts and the organic remains, which were still there. So not a study for everyone if you're squeamish, because, you know, latrine is just a fancy name for toilet.
Yeah.
And so what they've actually found is some of the earliest evidence for schistosomiasis outside of Africa. And what this is it's a disease or a condition you get from having this parasite, Schistosoma mansoni. And so what this parasite is it's just, it lives in the water and it's a flatworm. And so what it'll do, it'll burrow into your skin and then it'll get into your bloodstream and then it'll go into your intestines where it'll make camp and it'll reproduce and it'll produce eggs that then you pass out in your waste. And so, you know, you can imagine a latrine might collect these things.
Yeah.
And so what these scientists did is they went into the organic remains and they've actually found a preserved egg, which is quite amazing. This is a 500-year-old. This is like from the 15th century.
So pretty old flatworm. Do they usually last that long?
So it's obviously dead, but like right. An egg, but it's really well preserved.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I assume not, but there was probably, you can, if you start imagining the environment,
yeah,
it probably
right.
became very
good conditions,
anoxic. You know, not a lot of oxygen to cause deterioration and
right.
such. And why this is kind of interesting is because obviously it's old, so it's kind of cool anyway. But it's thousands of kilometres from where this is endemic, this parasite. So this parasite comes out of Africa. So how did it get here? Like, this is where we now start to see this crossover between what we know in history and archaeology and science. And so this latrine was actually part of what was known as the Spanish Nation House at the time. And it was basically the administrative centre and the meeting place for the Castilian merchant community. And so what they think is actually that this parasite is probably from a Spanish trader, right? So they've gone to Africa and they've gone and got commodities like ivory and spices and they've brought it back to Belgium to trade. And they've gone to this house and they've
brought something else back with them.
Yeah, you know, probably didn't feel so bad, but a dodgy belly. And
right.
And so it's kind of an exciting example of where you're combining historical record with archaeology and parasitological data, so you can start to think about things about understanding disease transmission in the past. Because, you know, like parasites, like these, it's like, you know, viruses and bacteria where you get transmission. And, you know, we're all very aware of infectious disease transmission now, right, in this world. And so you can start to understand how this epidemiology has changed with time. And, of course, also they've found this egg, but it's out of a lab that does ancient DNA. So the next thing that they're going to do is actually look at the DNA sequences and compare it to what's modern and kind of get in a sense of how this parasite's evolved over time.
So I'm guessing the parasite, we have similar variations now that have adapted to deal with people better. Wow, very interesting. And then what have we got here with climate variation and Chinese dynasties?
Yeah, so this is another story of combining kind of science
a bit
and
of
history.
A combination.
It was my lizard brain must have took over this week and picked these out. So China, a really old nation, right? Like it's got
one
a
of the
lot
oldest.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And so turns out in the since 2070 before Common Era time to 1912 Common Era time, so about now.
Yeah.
Common Era time being equivalent, sorry, like 2024 is Common Era time.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Sorry. So there's been 13 periods of different rule, so 13 dynasties, which I was like, okay, that's quite a surprise. And so,
yep.
And then China was obviously very reliant on agriculture before it became a very industrial nation.
As most countries would have been, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So nothing kind of surprising there. But what you can think of, you know, like the ruling group or party or however you want to rule, dynasty in this case, changes when you get a lot of civil unrest, obviously, right? And so if your food supply is very agricultural, you know, your economy is based on your agriculture, if you start to get a lot of climate changes or climate instability, this is obviously going to have an effect.
Yeah.
And so this is what they were interested in seeing. So China, you get Asian monsoons. So with an Asian monsoon, this is you'll get cool, dry winters, that you get some droughts, but then you'll get these really warm, wet summers and you'll get heavy rain between May and September, and you might even get some tropical cyclones that cause wreak havoc, right?
Yeah, so pretty dangerous conditions if you're a dynasty hoping to stick around, right?
Yeah. And so what they found, or what they did, was in central China is a cave, forgive the pronunciation, I'm probably going to get this very wrong, Heshang cave, and it has what are called speleotherms that record the last 200 years of history. So a speleotherm, you will know it of if you think of a cave where you get the stalactites, which are the things that hang down from the top, or the stalagmites, that are the things that come up from the bottom.
Yep.
Right, and so speleotherm is just the collective term, and how these form is basically you get groundwater leaching out of the cave, and so you get a lot of calcium buildup, and they just basically deposit minerals.
Yep.
But what's really cool about these is they actually have growth bands. And so you can, it's a bit like, you know, like looking at a tree. You can start to look at these growth bands. And what they've done here is if you look at oxygen that's in the mineral, most of the oxygen we breathe is oxygen 16. So it has eight protons in its nucleus. But you also get another type of oxygen, oxygen 18, where it's got 10 neutrons now. So these are called isotopes. And so you can look at the ratio of 18 to 16, and it can be used as a proxy for precipitation. So how much rain were we getting? Because it's all about the water cycle.
We get more 18 or 16 during rain?
You get less 18 during rain.
Right, okay. Yeah.
And so that's what they basically did. They looked at these growth bands, they looked at these isotope ratios. And so from year one to year 400, you had less oxygen 18. And so they know this coincides with the Roman warm period, so you had more precipitation.
Yeah.
Whereas year 400 to 1800, you had an increase of oxygen 18, and this coincides with the Dark Age cold period, so there was less precipitation. And so what they've done is obviously they've looked over time at how the precipitation and how the climate's changing, and what they've found is when it starts to change and it becomes quite variable, you get this dynasty change.
Yeah, so we're assuming, you know, food becomes scarce, people become angry.
Yep.
Flip the switch.
Yep.
Stays fine for a while and then it happens again.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. There's that idea, because you've got, what I learned that like more than 80% of the Chinese population actually lives in East China and has done since 221. Before common era time, so
right.
BC.
So for a while,
right? And so as soon as growing conditions there aren't great,
get mass unrest. Yeah. Wow, really interesting. And then lastly here, invasive species becoming threatened themselves. What even, how does that happen?
Okay, so this is referred to as a nature conservation paradox. And what it is that, so we, here in New Zealand, we know this, like we grow up with this fact that we have these introduced species and they cause extinctions, right? Yep. And they're mainly introduced by humans. And in the last few decades, species being introduced into an area is partly responsible for at least like 60% of the species that have gone extinct. But what can also happen is that introduced species, where it's actually native, it becomes threatened. And so it's this idea, well, should you, if you have a non-native population of species that's actually endangered in another place, do you protect it or do you get rid of it?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of examples right now.
Yeah.
Possums maybe and...
Yep.
Yeah, gorse also is a weird one, I think. Yeah.
The wildest example that I learned reading this paper, the European rabbit. Wild rabbits, absolute pest in New Zealand.
Yep.
No one's going to save those, right? In France, Spain and Portugal, where they're native, they're endangered. So do we protect them?
You'd think throw them all on a boat and ship them back, right?
Oh, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Another one in New Zealand is the Himalayan tar. So that you find on the Southern Alps, and that decimates plant life, right? It's not done a lot of our native plant life a lot of good. But in Nepal and Bhutan, where it's native, it's not quite endangered yet. It's near threatened. And so, yeah, it's like, what do you do? And so this study, actually, what it was doing was, in terms of mammals, it was just quantifying the problem. So they did like a large survey. And what they found is there's 230 non-native mammals that have been introduced by humans into other places, which I actually thought there was quite a small number.
Yeah, that seems quite low.
But then I started thinking, mammals, they're actually, compared to birds and fishes and everything, mammals, there's not actually that many different species.
Right.
But
okay.
Yeah. And 36 of these are actually threatened in their homeland, the original homeland, so where they're native. And most of those that are threatened actually originate out of tropical Asia, and this is basically because of massive forest destruction and overhunting and stuff. But what also found really interesting with this is when they decide or when they do the list of global extinction risk, it's actually only based on the natural range. So if an animal starts appearing as near extinction or endangered and stuff,
yes,
it's only where it is naturally.
So any animals that are somewhere else don't count towards that list.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Which, yeah, I found kind of surprising. So what they said is if you did count the non-native range in this calculation, like 22% of those species that are analysed for being endangered or would actually become not endangered anymore. So
an interesting case there. But I assume it would be quite, I mean, a logistical nightmare to get them back, right?
Yeah, it is. And so it's kind of this, you know, they did conclude, you know, like the main focus does still need to be preservation, protecting in the native area. And then obviously weighing up the opportunities and risks in other areas. But you can kind of think of it, you know, New Zealand, we've done a lot of work with birds where we've, you know, there's been breeding programs and you've got to consider genetic diversity and all this sort of thing. So maybe we can send a few back to make sure that their breeding efforts, genetically still good and stuff.
And also, if we have a whole bunch of birds here, I mean, we've proven that these species can't really coexist. So,
yeah,
maybe keep them. All right. Well, very interesting stories this week. Definitely give this one a listen later on if you're only catching the end of it on the BFM website. Thank you, Kushla, for coming in this week. Thank you, Moshe, as always. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.